Hello.
Hello there. How you doing?
A little stressed out, running up and down, trying to get here, and I got here on time. I'm so
happy. Got here on time. Yay. I'm so glad that you did.
You vegans, you look lovely as always.
Thank you. You too. You look all dressed up.
I just lectured at our medical school about 15 miles away, but traffic was light, so it was a little bit off, a little more than I should chew. I'm in a quiet place. I meant to bring headphones and I didn't bring, but hopefully you can hear me okay.
I can hear you perfectly and I don't have headphones on either. So it usually works beautifully. So, how do the medical students,
These are first year. It happens to be an osteopathic school of medicine.
So
50% are vegetarian.
Wow.
Do I hear that? All of them have seen What the Health. This was not prepared. This was just questions I was asking. I could not believe when I said, are any of you plant eaters? And it's a 50% of our class are vegetarian and a lot are vegan.
Wow.
Potential future, revolution.
This is it. This is how we change the state of healthcare. Yeah. We teach the doctors what they should be doing.
Yeah,
we teach the patients what they should be expecting. And everything else gets sandwiched.
The topic was, why am I a weird heart doctor?
We should have more weird heart doctors on. So Dr. Esselstein should be on any moment.
Oh, so it is going to be a three-way.
It's a three-way, yeah. I'm excited to have the two of you. What's that?
That's pretty cool.
Didn't Laura didn't tell you that?
Well, I saw that he was involved, but I didn't know if that was a separate interview.
There we go. He's there. Yeah.
Hi, Ann.
Oh, hi. That doesn't look like Dr. Esselstein.
That's miraculous, Ann.
It's Esselstein.
Esselstein. Why do I say Steen? Okay, Esselstein. Thank you.
Okay.
Good. Good.
Is everything all right?
Yeah, we can see you just fine.
It's all right.
Yeah, can hear you, can see you. Getting excited?
All right.
You have a bunch of people online live here.
Is this a live broadcast?
Yep.
Cool.
Yeah, so I'm hoping we have time to get in for some questions. Yay.
Wow.
Okay.
Wow. Hi, Doc.
Welcome. Hi. So great to have you here. Thank you for coming.
Yeah. Well, pleasure. Now, your name is?
Rita Marie.
All right. I got it.
All right. We met at the airport in Austin.
Yeah.
Less than a month ago.
Okay.
Cool. I'm so glad. Thank you so much for being here. So we have a live audience, health practitioners of various kinds, some MDs, some nurses, some health coaches, physical therapists. I'm looking on here, a whole bunch of different variety, personal trainers, all sorts. So, wide variety of folks and a captive audience. So we are going to
have any snake tamers or shamans or.
Oh, probably shamans. Yeah. I don't know about snake tamers, but certainly, spiritual and all over the map. And our, what we all have in common is that we're passionate about changing our healthcare system and getting people to be excited about food as medicine, instead of medicine, right? Food, not medicine, food instead of medicine. And we all just finished a conference. I held a conference here about a month ago, and these were all people that came to the conference, and we offered them as a bonus some extra trainings after the conference. So here you have it.
Thank you.
All right. So I'm going to go ahead and get us started. It looks like, let me make sure everybody's hearing us okay.
Yeah. Now, I anticipate this is what, 3 hours?
3 hours? We could go 3 hours, except I have another call at 7:30. So I was figuring on, 60 to 90 minutes. Does that work for your schedule?
60 would be best for me.
60's best? Okay. Good. All right. Great. And
I hear you fine. Dr. Esselstein, for me, is a little soft-toned. Do you hear him fine?
Go ahead and speak again, Dr. Esselstein.
Oh, it's so exciting to be with this handsome group.
Wonderful. It is a little bit low, so I don't know if I have the ability to raise your volume or not. Let me see. I don't. See if you can just get closer to the mic. I don't know.
Behind every great man is a greater woman.
Uh-huh. And behind every great woman is a great man.
Yeah.
No, it goes both ways. That's how I can do what I do.
Okay. Can you hear any better?
It's a little low. How about you? He does sound a little low, is what our guests are saying.
Yeah.
We could just raise the mic, and it's just a difference in the. See.
I think I would chew on some kale, Dr. Esselstyn. Chew on some kale; it cures everything.
I just had a bowl of cabbage. All right. Try again.
Well, I think let's get started.
All right, let's get started. All right. So hello, everybody, and welcome. We are here for our Shine VIP post-conference training. And I have today with me, I'm very excited to have with me, two esteemed guests. Both are cardiologists and both have really, I like to call it, you just specialize in heart stuff.
I would never want to be accused of being a cardiologist.
Okay, I know you had endocrinology and, no, tell me, what's your official title?
General surgeon.
General surgeon, okay.
Retired.
Retired general surgeon. Okay, so I like to call it having traded in the scalpel for the fork, so to speak, right? It's like, okay, cutting people open, cracking their chest, and doing surgery is not, in the long haul, doing them a service, but getting them to change their diet is. So we're here to share some tidbits about cardiovascular health. And what I wanted to do is offer, I want to start with a little bit of a bio. And both of these amazing doctors have these bios that are just chock full of the awards and publications, and they're very esteemed in their communities. So I wanted to start with Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn. Welcome. Esselstyn. I got to get that right. And I know your son, Rip. I've met him a few times here in Austin, and he's doing great work in the world as well. So appreciate your family contribution. So can I give them a little bit about your background? Is that okay?
Well, I don't want to detract from the from our presentations or our answering their questions. So
okay, I'll do it quickly. I'll do it quickly just so that they know that you're somebody to take seriously. BA from Yale, MD from Western Reserve University. This is an interesting tidbit. In 1956, the year I was born, he was winning a gold medal in the Olympics for the rowing team. Is that cool? An Army surgeon, chaired breast cancer task force, thyroid and parathyroid surgery, a fellow of the American College of Cardiology. And that's probably where I got the idea that you were a cardiologist. President of the American Association of Endocrine Surgeons. He's gotten awards from a lot of different places, including the 2015 Plant Nutrition Project, Case Western University School of Medicine Distinguished Alumni, College of Lifestyle Medicine Awards. I mean, on and on, over 150 publications in the literature, books. His famous book was about reversing heart disease, and he had a long-term study with people, and it's like they kept their improvements over time. Cardiovascular prevention and reversal program at Cleveland Clinic of Wellness Institute. So that's what he's currently doing. And he is, and his wife, Anne, who you may have gotten to see right at the beginning when we first came on, followed a plant-based diet since 1984. And they have 4 children and 10 grandchildren. So welcome. I'm so excited to have you here.
Thank you. Thank you, Rita Marie.
Yeah. Thank you for being here and for being you and for being doing the work you're doing. Dr. Joel Kahn, I've known for years, several years. We met through some Mindshare summits and other kinds of different healthcare conventions. He is the founder of the Kahn Center of Cardiac Longevity, clinical professor of medicine at Wayne State University, where he just came from teaching today. He graduated summa cum laude from the University of Michigan School of Medicine. I tell you these things because a lot of what they say is against the grain in terms of conventional medicine. And I just want to see that you understand where they're coming from is a place of having been there, done that, and seen some better ways to approach things. He has over 150 published articles, books. He's got 5 books. His his fifth book is coming out in January 2018, The Plant-Based Solution. His first book was The Whole Heart Solution. He's a national on national TV, and he knows his stuff, and he's a nice guy. So there we have it. So we've established credibility here. And what I would like to do, I have some questions that I would like to just have you guys address. And I'm very informal. So if I call you guys, I hope you don't find that insulting or anything, but that's just the way I speak. I learned that in New York where I grew up. And you know, we really, this whole conference was about food as medicine. And so cardiovascular disease is our number one killer and it's preventable, right? And it's also reversible in your experience. So I would love for each of you, you can see who wants to go first. If we want to go with seniority, we can do it that way, or you can just pipe in. Yes? Okay, so Dr. Esselstyn, let's just talk about your experience with reversing, preventing and reversing heart disease through the food, because I know you've done a lot of surgeries in your time. And how does it differ, and why is it superior to address with food?
Well, first of all, let me say that I'm grateful to be a part of your evening, and I'm particularly delighted to be working with Joel Kahn. We are by no means strangers, and it's been my privilege to be on faculty panels with Joel in the past. Let's just see if I can't abbreviate this as much as possible, and that is, right now I think that Joel and I are as concerned as many other physicians are, that we have gone ahead and constructed a billion-dollar health industry in this country around an illness that does not even exist in half of the planet. And that's a pretty discouraging fact. Now, what has happened is that we have now really elucidated what is the causation of this disease. You simply look at these other cultures and you find that there is no cardiovascular disease in Okinawa or rural China or the Papua Highlands or Central Africa or the Tarahumara in northern Mexico. Why? They thrive on whole food, plant-based nutrition. And so, quite simply, my research was, being a general surgeon, it was pretty simple and straightforward. Can we take these patients who have devastated themselves by eating the Western diet, see if we can get them to convert to eating whole food, plant-based nutrition, and then see if we can't charter their progress, see if they can, A, halt the disease, and B, can they also perhaps even reverse the disease? And I started a small study back in 1985 of some 24 patients, and we had some very exciting results. Actually, not only did they thrive, but we were able, in a significant number, to document a disease reversal. And really, that has led to a second study, larger, with close to 4 years of follow-up on some 198 patients. And what was particularly gratifying about this group was that we found that the adherence to our program was 89.3, almost 90%.
Wow.
And the key here, really, and we can get into this a little bit further in detail, is without compliance, this whole effort falls flat on its face. So it really is the challenge for the physician is to develop a way of reaching the patients so that they will absolutely become 100% ideally adherent to whole food, plant-based nutrition. And when physicians say that their patients won't do it, it's not that the message is wrong. It's really how the message is articulated. And I think I'll stop there and pick it up later because I think it's a good
start. Yeah. All right. So that's great because that's the piece that so many of us want to hear. And I hear that over and over again that people say, well, how do you get them to do it? I mean, how do you get them to actually follow through? And of course, adherence is key because it's not like taking a drug and, you know, it's going to mask the symptoms and make you think you're okay. And it's hard work. It's not like pop the pill, take it down. But getting your chest cracked open is kind of hard work too. So, yeah. So, Joel, Dr. Kahn, would you like to address that? What's your experience been with, you know, as a cardiologist, and have you done surgeries with people in the past or stent them for surgery? What's been your experience?
Yeah, I mean, my reason I'm here with you today is just a little different than Dr. Esselstyn's, but I walked into freshman year University of Michigan 40 years ago this year, and I adopted a plant-based diet. I didn't like anything but the salad bar. Had nothing to do with ethics, the environment, or medical research. Actually, it's an interesting side story because last year I spoke to the Dietitian Association of Michigan, and the food service director of that dorm came up to me afterwards because I had mentioned that. And he goes, you owe me a big thank you because I'm the guy that made the food so bad and the salad bar so bad that I actually changed your career. That's actually true. So when I started my career of putting balloons in hearts as a staff doctor in Ann Arbor in 1990, I'd actually been eating plant-based for 13 years. I didn't mention it to anybody because that year, in fact, 3 weeks after I started putting balloons everywhere, I mean, just, you know, we called it angioplasty, treating heart attacks. A paper by a colleague of Dr. Esselstyn and mine, Dr. Dean Ornish, was published. And I was just weird enough, because we didn't talk about fake research and fake news in 1990. I actually read that and I believed that. And I said, holy moly, I've been feeding myself a therapy that I didn't know was a therapy. I didn't know at the time of Dr. Esselstyn's research. He published a little bit later, and then his book, you know, greatly contributed to my patients and my own education. And we are on the same team very closely now. But so actually I had the experience since 1990, when you were getting a procedure where I was sticking needles in your body, you were learning about kale and broccoli and plants and the harms of Western diet. That still sadly remains a very tiny percentage of cardiologists in the country. And I take no credit for being a genius. I actually was just gullible enough to study the research and believe it was close to harmless and potentially, you know, paradigm shifting. And it's turned out since 1990, the support has grown so much exponentially in research, and I've seen it in my own patients. Dr. Esselstyn's research has some of the most dramatic angiograms before and after showing improvements in coronary artery pathology that are, you know, proof of the potential for the body to heal itself when you apply a plant-based diet without added oils. I use a little different strategy of a specialized ultrasound of the carotids. But I mean, every week in my clinic, I see atherosclerosis being reversed. A little different technique. It's real. It happens. It is hard work. You said that. And Dr. Esselstyn will tell you, why didn't he have 2,800 people in his initial study? Because it's easier for patients to take 5 pills than to change 3 meals a day, 7 days a week in restaurants and vacation and at family gatherings.
Yeah.
But the support we have nowadays is so much greater. And as you mentioned, I just came from our medical school and lectured to first year medical students. 50% raised their hands and said they were vegetarians or vegans. And it blew me away. I mean, that's what 23 and 24-year-olds who have decided on a medical career apparently are recognizing. My God, that statistic was 0.5% during Dr. Esselstyn's beginning of his career and, you know, even my own. And we got so much work to do, but, you know, youth will be the answer. They're getting it. So I'm excited.
I'm excited to hear that more and more adopting that. I know my son, who's 23 and he's been plant-based since he was born. He's saying he has all these people that come up to him and say, oh, but I'm vegan. And like they're, you know, and he goes, I've been doing it since I'm born. Like they discovered something brand new. And he's like, well, it's kind of cool though that these kids are seeing the light in eating more plants and, you know, especially today, right now. So I'm going to just address before we go into the compliance issue is there's this big push on paleo, right? Paleo diet. And when we look at paleolithic animals, I mean, creatures, I look and say, well, paleo was you eat a lot of berries, you eat a lot of roots, you eat a lot of leaves, and every now and then you get a kill and you eat animals and then you go back to eating the rest of it. But what we see in this modern paleo movement is that 3 meals a day, people are loading up on animal food, and some of them are doing it decently with lots and lots of plants too, lots and lots of greens, but others aren't because they're focusing on that and claiming that this research that you guys are seeing in your practices, in your carotid scans, is somehow flawed. And I would love to hear your opinions about that.
I would just like to go ahead, Joel.
Okay, I mean, the common enemy is the standard Western diet that people that aren't probably watching this recording, because you've got already a group of people dedicated to, you know, learning and advancing their health and their nutrition, are following. So the common enemy is people that are 60 to 65% of their calories are gas station, vending machine, cafeteria, boxes, microwave, plastics, wrapped, pre-packaged foods that are refined and processed and, you know, heavily animal-based and high in added sugars, high in added oils. We do share with the paleo movement, at least bringing the conversation to the table, that the current standard is failing American health, Western right. health, you know, miserably. And then there's the two paths of predominantly or solely either plant strong or plant only, which I think all three people on this screen are strongly advocating. Or, you know, you're right. There are some versions of a super clean, produce-rich diet using meat as a condiment. Now, I don't do that. And the science that that can prevent and reverse heart disease is absent. But it is better than eating
way better.
McDonald's burgers and fries and, you know, Pizza Hut pizza and buckets of KFC. So I don't throw the paleo movement out, but you're right. I watch my friends on Twitter literally eat meat-only diets for 30 to 45-day challenges, and this testosterone crazy psychology that's healthy. And I mean, the truth is, and Dr. Esselstyn is our researcher extraordinaire in this audience, there is only one style of diet that's been shown to prevent and reverse the number one killer of men and women in the Western world, which is cardiovascular disease. And that is a diet that is not in the pattern of the paleo diet. It's in the pattern of Dr. Esselstyn's research and a few other august researchers. So, short-term studies, you can lose weight, you can improve your insulin sensitivity and your cholesterol and blood pressure. Some go as far as 1 year follow-up, but none involve really the endpoint that predominantly matters, which is, are you on the road to heart attack, stroke, peripheral vascular disease, or are you on the road to preventing and actually healing that? So it can't be endorsed in my practice for my cardiovascular patients.
If you want to, I agree with Joel, if you want to develop diabetes quickly, you eat meat. If you want to develop cancer, you eat meat. If you want to develop heart disease, you eat meat. Stanley Hazen at the Cleveland Clinic has done some very interesting research where he looked specifically at the molecules of what we call lecithin and carnitine. These are found in dairy products. They're found in meat, fish, chicken, turkey, and seafoods. In all other words, in animal products. And what makes it problematic is he found that when an omnivore eats those animal products, mm-hmm. their gut bacteria has the capacity to metabolize lecithin and carnitine into a nasty molecule called TMA, trimethylamine. It's rapidly oxidized in your liver to trimethylamine oxide. And trimethylamine oxide is a molecule that really savages your blood vessel. Now, the other thing that he found that was quite striking, when he took somebody who was totally plant-based and fed them a lamb chop and then measured their blood for TMAO, not there, or at most a tiny, tiny little bit. Mm-hmm. In other words, people who are plant-based do not possess bacteria in their gut that mm-hmm. has the capacity to make TMA or TMAO. So it's a very, very plausible, very, very absolutely rock solid bit of research that it shows the downside of eating meat. Now, I'd like to at this point segue into to help your audience know why it is from a standpoint of research, why it is that a whole food plant-based nutrition can help these patients. First of all, I think all experts would agree that where this disease has its inception, its onset, its beginning, is when we progressively injure the life jacket and the guardian of our blood vessel, which happens to be that delicate innermost lining of the artery called the endothelium.
Yeah.
And what makes the endothelium so remarkable is its ability to produce this fantastic molecule of gas, nitric oxide, which is truly the molecule responsible for the protection and salvation of all of our vasculature. For example, it has a number of truly remarkable functions. One, nitric oxide keeps all the cellular elements within our bloodstream flowing smoothly like Teflon rather than Velcro. It keeps things sticky. Number two, nitric oxide is the strongest vessel dilator in the body. When you climb stairs, the arteries to your heart, the arteries to your legs, they widen, they dilate. That's nitric oxide. Number three, nitric oxide will protect the wall of the artery from becoming thickened, stiff, or inflamed. It protects us from getting high blood pressure or hypertension. Number four, now this is the absolute key. A safe and normal amount of nitric oxide protects us from ever developing blockages or plaque. So literally, everybody on the planet, whether they're in Detroit, whether they're in Cleveland, whether they're in Chicago or London or Berlin, if they've developed cardiovascular diseases, because in the preceding decades, they have now so sufficiently trashed, injured, and compromised the capacity of their endothelial cells to make nitric oxide, they no longer have enough to protect themselves from making blockages or plaque. Mm. But the good news here is this. This is not a malignancy. This is a completely benign disease. And if we can get patients to stop ever passing through their lips again any food morsel that is going to further injure their already train wrecked endothelium, it can recover. It makes more nitric oxide. It makes enough nitric oxide so you can halt the disease and often gets disease reversal. So now, what are the foods that every time they pass your lips, you injure the endothelial cell? They are any oil: olive oil, corn oil, soybean oil, safflower oil, sunflower oil, coconut oil, palm oil, oil in a cracker, oil in a piece of bread, oil in a salad dressing, or anything with a mother or a face: meat, fish, chicken, fowl, turkey, and eggs, or anything that's dairy: milk, cream, butter, cheese, ice cream, and yogurt. And we got to go very easy on sugary drinks, Cokes, Pepsis. Go very carefully on cakes, pies, cookies, stevia, agave, excesses of maple syrup, molasses, and honey. And I don't particularly like coffee with caffeine. Decaf, okay, or tea with caffeine, but I don't like coffee with caffeine. Now, therefore, what are you going to eat? You're going to eat all these marvelous whole grains for your cereal, bread, pasta, and rolls, and bagels, 101 different types of legumes and lentils, beans, all those wonderful white and especially sweet potatoes, and also red, yellow, and green leafy vegetables and some fruit. Now, there is one other wrinkle that we've changed just in the last 6.5 years, and that is if I ask the patient if they could get their head inside that artery that Dr. Khan has elegantly been able to treat in the past with these balloons and stents, if they could get in their head in their artery and they looked at the plaque, they would see an absolute cauldron of oxidative inflammation. Therefore, what we need truly is antioxidants, all right? Now, that means where are you going to get the antioxidants? Don't go down to the health food store and buy a jug of pills that says antioxidant, because it won't work and it's going to be harmful. We're going to ask you to get your antioxidants from food, okay? What's food that is high in what we call ORAC value, O-R-A-C, oxygen radical absorptive capacity. So if you're having raspberries, blueberries, strawberries, and blackberries on your morning oat cereal, terrific start. But nothing can trump the antioxidant value of green leafy vegetables. So I'm asking these patients now 6 times a day to chew a green leafy vegetable approximately the size of their fist after it has first been boiled in water, 5.5 to 6 minutes, so it's nice and tender. Then they must anoint it with several drops of a delightful balsamic vinegar. Why? Because the acetic acid in the vinegar has been shown to restore the nitric oxide synthase enzyme contained within the endothelial cell that is responsible for making nitric oxide. And they're going to chew this alongside their alongside their breakfast cereal, again, mid-morning snack, again with their luncheon sandwich. That's three, mid-afternoon four, dinner time five, and I adore it when they have that evening snack of kale. What are you doing? All day long, you are bathing and basking that horrible oxidative cauldron of inflammation with nature's most powerful antioxidants. And it really is so powerful, especially with the patients who come to see you with chest pain and angina, how rapidly it begins to diminish. Now, what are the greens that I'm talking about? They are bok choy, Swiss chard, kale, collards, collard green, beet greens, mustard green, turnip greens, napa cabbage, Brussels sprouts, broccoli, cauliflower, cilantro, parsley, spinach, and arugula, and asparagus. And the top six are kale, Swiss chard, spinach, arugula, beet greens, and beets. I'm sorry to be so long, but I just wanted to, next time I'll try to talk about how to get compliance.
Okay, we'll do that next time around. Thank you. Thank you. Just getting back to the nitric oxide, quick question. There's a lot of, there's the little test strips that you can test. You find those to be valid. And then there's people doing little lozenges that are derived from beet and beet greens and spinach and other things that are supposed to raise the nitric oxide. Thoughts on those?
I actually have an active clinic testing for the ability to make nitric oxide. Question one, do you get an erection? I got to wake your audience up a little bit.
Most of us don't because we're female. Although Brandon,
Dr. Esselstyn just talked about motivation. So you're going to eat kale six times a day if you care about your erection.
I love it.
That's happening because of nitric oxide production.
Right.
Number two, although this is not common, there is a blood test. It's actually done by the lab owned by the Cleveland Clinic called Cleveland Heart, called EDMA. And I actually do that routinely on my patients. If your level's elevated, your nitric oxide production's low. If your level's low, your nitric oxide production is therapeutic and fine. And there actually is finally a little machine called an endopath that actually measures endothelial function. But, you know, and it's interesting because a large percentage of my patients have blood vessels that are not reacting and allowing hyperemic flow or adequate flow. But, to get back, so nitric oxide is, I just spoke to the medical students hour and a half ago about nitric oxide, and I talked about beets and arugula and, you know, and kale and six times a day and kale in your oatmeal, and there were pictures on my PowerPoint of Dr. Esselstyn and his visits to Detroit. But what about the paleo movement, just to close up? You know, this is, it's interesting too. It's based on a 1985 peer-reviewed article in the New England Journal of Medicine called Paleolithic Nutrition by Dr. Boyd Eaton, a Canadian radiologist who put together a beautiful hypothesis about how our health would be better if we patterned our diet after that of the Paleolithic era. From that came a Dr. Lauren Cordain, who wrote the book, The Paleo Diet. And if you read the first edition, we actually all could agree with about 80% in that book.
Yep.
He despises Western diet. He hates saturated fat excess in the diet. He doesn't like added sugars. His second edition kind of went off, and all of a sudden he loves eggs and other things he didn't love so much in the first edition. Well, you know, one of the most telling, I think it's now November 2015, Dr. Boyd Eaton spoke in Boston as a follow-up to his publication 20 years earlier at a group called, they're the group that promotes the Mediterranean diet. They have a great website. I'm blanking on it for a minute. And he actually announced, stop doing what I said to do 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. We won't have a planet if you follow this Paleolithic diet that is being taught in CrossFit gyms and by certain functional medicine experts. Stop. Maybe we should do it again down the road when we clean up our waters, our air, stop cutting down our forests. This is not a tenable diet. And he basically backed off and said, eat at least vegetarian. And, you know, he was truly the modern founder of the movement. So, you know, we predominantly talk vascular function, endothelial function, nitric oxide. You know, these kids in the audience at the medical school, if I ask them why, I think they are very concerned about the environment, and they're reading about greenhouse gases. Yeah. And they're reading a major presentation in England 3 weeks ago that grass-fed beef is no better for the environment than factory farm beef. And it's, you know, it's a selling point that has no substance to it. And they're concerned about, you know, animal cruelty and animal rights. These These are less the focus of cardiovascular specialists like Dr. Estelson and I, but they are grabbing the imagination of the public. The paleo and the CrossFit gyms are losing some interest, and we're seeing What the Health and other movements that are bringing people into the real world, that there's a single answer for the planet, for the animals, and for human physiology, which is fill your plates rich with brightly colored fruits and vegetables, and almost everything will go well for you.
Yeah. I love what you're saying, and I know that a lot of colleagues of mine and yours, they'll say, well, the least healthy people I see, the ones with the most health challenges, are vegans. And I always say, look, there's the difference between there's a junk vegan diet and there's a whole foods plant-based diet, which is rich in vegetables. So almost I'm like of the fan of calling it a vegetable rich diet, right? As opposed to plant, because some of the plants, I mean, you just fill your plate with soy that looks like meat, which is what many people do, or they fill their plates with, you know, rice and tofu and whole wheat bread and whatever, jelly beans, and those are all vegan, but they're not foods that are supporting heart health or any other kind of health. And then, so we get this skewed opinion, in my opinion, that a vegan diet is not a healthy diet, a plant-based diet is not a healthy diet, because of the people who are doing it wrong, basically. What are your comments on that?
I think that you, when you talk about, by the way, in my book, I have never used any of the B words, either vegetarian.
I don't use it either. So good. I'm glad to hear that.
I treat vegans for heart disease. Yeah. Vegans eat oil. They eat French fries. They eat glazed donuts.
Yep.
And they eat all these fake products that are really highly processed. And I think when you think about whole food plant-based nutrition, the idea of whole food plant-based nutrition, you get this concept, you're not eating out of a box, a bag, or a can.
No.
Once you start eating out of a box, a bag, or a can, you've got to read the list of ingredients. And so often in those ingredients is going to be sugar, salt, fat, and oil. And when you go into the grocery store and you go to the produce section, you never have to read an ingredient list.
Right.
When you pick up bok choy, Swiss chard, kale, collards, what is it? It's just the product itself, as right. grown. There's nothing fake about it. There's nothing processed about it. It's perfectly safe. Let me transition into it, because I promised you I'd talk a little bit.
Yeah, getting them to do it.
Patients, because this is the stumbling block and the challenge. Right now, and I think Joel would perhaps agree with this, the whole paradigm of medicine since World War II has gone half-cocked, really off the rails. It's become totally symptomatic medicine. You have a chronic illness, you get a pill. If you have hypertension, you get a pill. If you get diabetes, you get a pill. If you have rheumatoid arthritis, you get a pill. If you've got multiple sclerosis, you get pills. Now, that 15-minute visit, there is never a discussion about the etiologic determinants of that malady. In other words, what did the patients or what has transpired that caused that illness to develop? We're now at a stage where actually whole food plant-based nutrition has the capacity to really destroy 75% to 80% of chronic illness.
Mm-hmm.
But it is not going to be done with a procedure or an operation or with a pill. It's only going to happen when you have patients become more sophisticated about the lifestyle that we're asking them to follow. And that's going to be a very, very significant change from the Western diet. Because when anybody dares tell me that the diet that I prescribe for these patients with heart disease is extreme, my answer to them immediately is, look, let's be clear about one thing. This diet that we're asking these patients to eat is eaten by those and half the planet who never have heart disease. The most extreme, draconian, strict diet on the planet is the one that guarantees that 97% of Americans are going to perish with some chronic illness.
Mm-hmm.
So how do you get these patients to adhere to this change? I think several things have happened that have greatly accelerated this. There have been a number of books. There have been some films that have been really quite provocative and have caught the attention of people. And as Joel mentioned, of course, there has been increasingly word of mouth. But where I felt so challenged, I'm going to give you two examples. With my original group back in 1985, I was deeply concerned about the rock upon which the study was most likely to flounder would be lack of patient compliance. And therefore, since I was not a psychologist, I decided to use the same mantra for these patients that I had learned years ago and applied to my cancer patients. This was something I learned from a marvelous West Coast surgeon named Bert Dunphy. And Bert used to say that patients with cancer are not afraid to suffer. Patients with cancer are not afraid to die. But patients with cancer are afraid of being abandoned by their family or by their physician. And so for the first 5 years of that study, I was seeing every one of these patients every 2 weeks in the office. We would check their cholesterol, weight, blood pressure, and I would go over every morsel they ate. At the end of 5 years, I got a little courageous and I stretched it out to monthly. At the end of a decade, 10 years, now they were pretty well on autopilot, and I was able to stretch it out to quarterly. And then at 12 years, which made it, I think, one of the longest studies of its type in cardiovascular disease, at 12 years is when I wrote up the results of what we were finding. Now, and we frequently would, it was a small group, so we would frequently meet maybe every 3 or 4 months at our house or somebody else's, where people would bring what would be an acceptable potluck. And the group would kind of get together and share stories and common interests. And it was a little bit of a bonding. It was important. However, when I got rehired by the Cleveland Clinic after I retired from surgery and at the Wellness Institute, by then the movie had sort of had taken wings. And 85% of the patients were coming from outside the state of Ohio. So there was no way that I could see these patients on a repetitive basis. I'd get one shot at them. Yes. So it was my responsibility to sort of put together a seminar, very intensive, one single day, 6 hours. During that seminar, though, they are going to learn all that I can share with them about how they created their disease, precisely how they can be empowered as the locus of control to halt and reverse their disease. Now, how do you make this happen? You show the patient respect. The only way I know to show a patient respect is to give them my time. So two things I think have happened there. One, we limit usually the number of people that I counsel at any one time at this seminar is usually no more than 12. Always with their significant other or spouse. Because if you try to have somebody understand this and their spouse is not there, you've lost it. I mean, it's just not going to happen. It's too significant. Unless both parties understand the science and the rationale behind it. So they get this 6 hours. And at that 6 hours, they're going to get a very hefty notebook in addition that has a copy of every PowerPoint that I use, several of our scientific articles, and a 44-page handout with many additional recipes that add to the 240 that will be in the two books that we provide. There's a marvelous hour and a quarter presentation from a woman who's had 30 years experience acquiring and preparing plant-based foods, dealing with reading ingredients, travel in restaurants, and then everybody is given a DVD of the entire seminar. So if they go home and get forgetful, rusty, they can flip this on and get themselves back up to speed. And we always have three local or regional participants who've had a previous successful experience share their story with those in attendance who can then say to themselves, listen, if he or she can do this, I can do this.
Yeah.
Then we answer all questions, have a delightful plant-based luncheon, and then stay in touch as necessary through email or phone call. But when we looked up that group and I reported them in July of 2014 in the Journal of Family Practice, we were running about 89.3% compliance. And the other thing that I think is so important is when my secretary gives me a list of the patients who are coming 2 weeks beforehand, and that gives me time to personally, each one of these people, I have to call myself, and I want to get my arms around their story and have them opportunity to ask questions of me so that coming to the seminar, we have a strong platform on which we can all move forward. But if this kind of approach could somehow be delegated to patients with hypertension, to patients with diabetes, to patients with multiple sclerosis, et cetera, to get them to make these lifestyle changes. And I just heard today that there's going to be a very exciting new journal, which I think will get everybody's attention. It's going to be called the the Journal of Disease Reversal.
Hmm. I like that.
How exciting will that be?
Yeah. Awesome. Awesome. I love what you shared, because it's very much in line with what I teach and these practitioners who are in the program, is we've got to educate people. You can't just give them something to do and not educate them about the why they're doing it. And when you take the time with them and you educate them and you coach them and support them through making the changes, that's when you get results.
But what Joel was doing with these medical students, we never had any training in nutrition. It's remarkable. Mm-hmm. And here he is getting these first year Wayne medical students to be aware of the possibility. Who on their faculty would ever do that if it weren't for Joel?
That's right.
And I will say, and as a shout out to Dr. Esselstyn, when I see clinic patients, and it's always shocking, 5 years, 10 years, 20-year history of advanced cardiovascular disease, I give them a quiz. Have you ever heard of Forks Over Knives? Have you heard the name Esselstyn? Ever heard the name Ornish? And usually it's 0-3, and that's not a reflection on them. It's a reflection on a medical system. But they have to leave my office with a copy of Forks Over Knives and Dr. Esselstyn's Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease. He probably doesn't know it. I think I buy more copies of his books than any other human. I'm not even joking about that. I'm serious. You know, that's different strategy than his not one-on-one, but 12-on-1, 6-hour seminar, which I've been to, and it is an awesome event, and I would recommend it to anybody seeking that. But even just watching that single DVD and reading his book and the amazing recipes that are half the book at the back, it's life-changing for so many people. I mean, that's the first time they've heard there may be a way out of, you know, heart disease and other chronic diseases. So. You know, it is quite remarkable how this is still one of the best kept secrets in the Western world.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Wow. So I had a couple of other questions I wanted to run by you, because these are things that we hear over and over again, kind of the objections to this approach, but the whole genetics piece, right? It's my genetics, right? My mom died at age 56, sudden death from heart attack. My dad followed her 2 years later. Right. So I know that there's some genetic tendencies, but I also know that there were lifestyle issues there, and I've adopted a completely different lifestyle. But can you address that? The people who are scared, they're like, oh, my mom and dad died of it. I'm going to have it. Are there particular genes? I know the APOE4/4 is talked about a lot. What's your stand on that? What do you tell people when they ask about that?
I'll be happy to jump in again. I use a lab through the Cleveland Clinic, even though I'm in Detroit, and Dr. Esselstyn's at the Cleveland Clinic, called Cleveland Heart. And most of my patients actually do get, I would call it 3-4 genetic tests routinely. I do check lipoprotein A, because I do think it's a secret bad actor. It's a form of cholesterol. It is genetic in its inheritance. Its inheritance isn't easily worked out at this point. And you can do a lot of things right and end up with atherosclerosis if you're one of the 63 million Americans that has an extremely high lipoprotein A level. Right. I'm almost curious, and I'll quickly finish up. If, there's not much yet written about plant-based nutrition and lipoprotein A, because indeed there's not much in the medical world other than measuring it, what we actually know for certain to do with it.
Yeah.
Although we do know it's directly atherosclerotic, and there are people that suffer and even die with that probably as their single risk factor. When I find it, I obviously am going to tell them about plant-based nutrition, but I'm going to tell them even if their lipoprotein A is normal. But, I want to hook them in that you've got even more reason than average. That's 20% of Americans. I will check APOE. Same thing. If they happen to be 4-4, I'm going to tell them the research suggests plant-based nutrition with low saturated fat, low oil, is their genetic inheritance and the diet that they should follow. But I'm going to tell the other people the same thing too. Right. But I want to hook at least that person
right. More
deeply with my fish hook based on their genetics. And so, I'll check methylation status. That's a whole different story. The reality is, for all the wonderful body of data we have on plant nutrition and prevention and reversal of a variety of diseases, we know that lifestyle trumps lifestyle, genetics load the gun, lifestyle pulls the trigger, and similar statements. And I strongly believe that. But I think where, Dr. Esselstyn I mean, I'll ask you, are we addressing 100% of cardiovascular risk by eating whole food, plant, no added oil diets? If we're addressing 98%, we've still done something so amazing.
Right.
The message has to be strong, clear, and not confusing to the public. But I think, we're entering an era where we will learn more and more genetics at a lower and lower cost. It'll be interesting to see how that plays into. I've had my entire genome sequenced. Right. I'm one of the first 40,000 people on the planet that can tell you every single nucleic acid in my chromosomes. But I'm a little crazy, and I'm doing this about 5 years before I think it will become routine, and maybe it will have clinical implications. But that used to cost $100,000, and now it costs $1,000 to talk about the speed of technology.
Mm-hmm. And with 23andMe, it's down to like 200.
That's SNPs. I've actually had complete genome sequencing with Craig Venter. That's the real deal.
Okay.
I know what I got 58 years and 9 months ago at the moment. There was a combination.
Wow.
Thanks, Mom and Dad.
Yeah, thanks.
Yeah, I think you bring up some fascinating points. For instance, the alpha small a, about 1997, when I was involved with putting on the second national conference on the elimination and prevention of coronary disease, and this was in Epcot in Disney World in Orlando. And one of the professors who was on our faculty was Greg Brown, who was who is from the University of Washington in Seattle. And his contention was that if you could keep the LDL under control, that the LP small a would be okay. My own approach is a little bit the way I look at increasingly at cholesterol. Now, I was a little harsh in my book, sort of suggesting that if everybody could get their cholesterol under 150 without drugs, they would probably be heart attack proof. And I think that probably is still a valid saying. But one of the things you learn is that as I've gotten more and more involved with this, there are going to be some patients, let's say I take 1,000 patients, and they absolutely beautifully follow the whole food plant-based diet, with no exceptions. There are going to be many with a cholesterol under 150. There'll be many with a cholesterol 180 or 190. There's maybe some at 210 or 220. Why? Because they have a thermostat on their liver that says, this is the amount of cholesterol that you will need. Cholesterol, increasingly, I'm thinking, is not evil.
No.
We have had it circulating through our bloodstream since we were absolute infants. Mm-hmm. And it has been doing a tremendous job. Every cell in our body is made of cholesterol, basis for all our sex hormones, basis for vitamin D. So really, it's pretty essential stuff. Now, does it mean that somebody with a cholesterol of 220 or 210 is going to develop heart disease? Well, I don't really think that's the case at all. I think if you can emphasize to the patient, as long as they will keep their endothelial fortress intact.
Yes.
Look, because if cholesterol was that bad, we'd all be dead of it probably by the time we were 20 or 25. But if we're going to live longer and longer, we have got to be so careful that the food that we're eating does not decimate, trash, and injure the endothelium. Because once the endothelial fortress has a crack, a fissure, an opening, then mm-hmm. cholesterol can suddenly end up being where it's not supposed to be. Cholesterol was not supposed to be circulating in your subendothelial space in your artery. Mm-hmm. Cholesterol was supposed to be circulating in your bloodstream.
Right.
But once it gets into that subendothelial space, then we have this terrible crescendo of oxidative inflammation, and the whole problem begins to develop of atherosclerosis and heart disease. So my feeling is that if we really can get these patients with LP small a mm-hmm. to absolutely follow a diet where they will never injure their endothelial cells and keep it as a strong fortress, I think those patients are going to have a much more likely safe situation. I have one little wrinkle about genetics. I ask patients when they say about genetics, it's this way. Let's suppose you have a village next to a river. Now, during the flood season, when the river is really raging and high, only the very, very strongest swimmers can get across.
Mm.
But if we go plant-based, and by that I mean if we wait till the dry season, when the river is 4 inches deep, everybody gets across safely.
Hmm. That's a great analogy.
I want to follow up on the lipoprotein A, and I don't want to confuse your audience. They may be unaware of it. But again, 63 million Americans, 20% have an elevated risk factor they probably never heard of and never checked.
Right.
Dr. Linus Pauling, now deceased about 20 years, lived to, I think he was 93 years old, double Nobel Prize winning PhD, had a theory of atherosclerosis. I don't know, but it revolves around the fact that our vascular wall is made of collagen, that the biochemistry is that you need two essential nutrients to produce collagen, vitamin C and lysine, same collagen you need to avoid wrinkles in your face and beautiful glowing skin. And our arteries share that. That's why we might have this clue called an earlobe crease. That's both a sign of collagen failure in your earlobe and arterial disease within your heart. It's a fairly accurate sign. If anybody's listening and has a deep groove in their earlobe, go Google my name and read about it. It's interesting, right, it's funny. But Dr. Pauling said, even if you have an elevated lipoprotein A, if you'll flood your blood with foods rich in vitamin C and lysine, which happens to be the leafy greens, Dr. Hasselston wants us to eat, happens to be legumes that we all love as our main fiber source. I don't know that the theory's ever been tested if one of the cardiovascular advantages of a plant diet using whole foods that Dr. Hasselston is a world leader advocating as one of the benefits biochemically is because we are again the nutrients. We don't need bone broth to take exogenous cow-based collagen. We just need to feed our body the biochemical substrate, and we get glowing skin, and we get glowing arteries, and we actually can block the effect of lipoprotein A.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, you know, more than theory, there has been some follow-up animal data by a physician named Matthias Rath that says Dr. Pauling had some substance to that theory.
Super. Yeah, you know, so that The thing that comes up when you talk about lysine and high lysine is that arginine is so important for nitric oxide. So really everything's about balance. You don't want to overflood your body with lysine at the expense of arginine and then at the expense of nitric oxide. Any comments on that?
I mean, you know, using food-based, you know, nutrients to raise, to produce better collagen, better arterial structure. I mean, you can't overdo chickpeas because at some point your gastric content will tell you, I mean, there's only so much engine 2 oil for hummus you can possibly eat and you'll stop.
Yeah.
Supplement-wise, you could potentially do it. And certainly some people do have herpes breakouts with arginine-based supplements, but food-based, I'm unaware of that ever happening.
No, I do not. The only supplement that I suggest for my patients is B12.
Is what?
B12.
B12. Okay. Yeah, let's talk about B12 for a bit.
Okay. Well, I think there increasingly have been some studies when you go into a nursing home or extended care facility and carefully check the B12 levels of persons who are senior, it's not infrequent that you'll find somebody who is B12 deficient. Now, I think there are several things that account for that. And most importantly is as we get more senior, as we get over the age of 55 and 60, there is a decrease in our gastric acidity. And gastric acid is essential for the absorption of vitamin B12, as also is our intrinsic factor also in our stomach, which also tends to abate or decrease as we become more senior. So we were fortunate for years to have at the clinic a world famous gentleman who had an incredible knowledge of B12 metabolism. And he always suggested that over the age of 60, 500 micrograms a day, and over 70, as much as 1,000 micrograms a day.
Okay.
Yeah, and you know, the soft underbelly that vegans are often accused of is, if it's such a great diet, why do you have to take supplements? And, you know, we hear that. Some would say it may be rational. Dr. Michael Greger talks about a small dose of vitamin D, a small dose of algae-based omega-3, or lots of chia, flax, hemp, greens, you know, a few walnuts a day for the precursor to EPA and DHA. But even if you take one or three supplements that recognize some nutritional, holes in the completely plant-based diet, and you end up with substantially lower risk of the largest causes of disease in the Western world, who gives a rip? You know, why don't we have, you know, B12 coated kale and just, you know, just build it into the system? It is true that it's part of the U.S. Preventive Task Force that people over 50 should take B12 across the
everybody, not just plant-based eating
population. So
right.
It's often pointed out, if, you know, I get that as a social media comment. If it's so great, right, why do you need a pill with it if it's so natural?
Well, I think you can make an argument, too, that the Tarahumara Indians, as far as I know, are not deficient in B12. Remember that we all make B12. And it's in the lower part of our gastrointestinal tract, and we're so hygienically focused that any little traces in our highly hygiene type of life, any traces of B12 that we make are never going to find its way to our mouth. But in some of the other cultures where the bathrooms are not so handy by, and I think the small amount of B12 that finds themselves from their body into their mouth is apparently enough to keep them from being B12 deficient, because I haven't heard that the Okinawans are taking B12 or that the Tarahumara Indians are taking B12. And so I think that you can make a strong case, but I don't think there's any question that I'm going to continue to ask my patients to take B12.
Yeah. And there's genetic factors that get involved with the B12 and the absorption, and there's a bunch of stuff like that. And I think that we're just so germ phobic that everything's sterilized and washed. And if you're just eating the kale out of the garden, you're still going to get traces of the soil and the bacteria in there, which will then make the B12 for you. And I've had mixed experiences with it. I had a, 20-year plant-based eater, 100% plant-based, no supplement, who was, you know, just if you tested, was marginally low, but really not low. And then I've had my son, for example, plant-based eater from birth, tested in his teens and was very low, and contributed to a lot of difficulties, puberty, and, you know, tendencies towards psychosis, that kind of stuff, as a teenager, and reversed that with a B12 supplement. But the point was, whatever the reason he was deficient that way, could have been any number of things, he was able to reverse it within 3 months with a patch, a B12 patch, and then he takes it every year or so. He goes on a binge where he says, I need B12, and then he stops, and then he goes back. So I think there are some genetic factors, there's some other things, and I don't think I personally don't think it points towards a deficit in the plant-based whole food diet as much as individual biochemical needs. Just my opinion. Right. And gut and flora problems. We know that gut flora problems will contribute to B12 deficiencies as well. And most people have been on antibiotics and pesticides, antibiotics on their food, et cetera, from early ages. And a lot of that plays in. Wow. We've covered a lot of ground here, haven't we? I just marked a couple of things that we hadn't talked about, which we had. And it just came up naturally. I didn't have to ask the question. So I had this list: supplements, genetic factors, cholesterol, value of cholesterol. So I've pretty much covered everything that I had on my list and wanted to cover. Is there anything more you'd like to add for as parting words for folks? And then we can certainly open up for questions.
I'd like to say thank you. And the reason, I guess, that even though it's been something like 56 years since I graduated from medical school, and 16 years since I retired from surgery, I really find myself more passionate than ever about what is the possible seismic revolution that we can see in medicine. Mm-hmm. And it truly is, it's a seismic revolution, because we can absolutely aside from things like auto accidents and some very, very rare genetic diseases, we are increasingly getting to the point where we have the skill set and the knowledge to absolutely get rid of chronic illness. It'll never happen with a pill. It'll never happen with a procedure or, for that matter, an operation. But the seismic revolution will come about when we have the will and the grit and the determination to share with the public what is the lifestyle, and most specifically, what is the nutritional literacy that will empower them as the locus of control to halt and to reverse chronic illness. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Well said. Joel, did you have anything you wanted to add?
I'd like to leave it with Dr. Esselstyn having the last words. It's an honor for me to be on a, what you call this, a video cast,
webinar, yeah.
A blog, a webinar, but honestly, I wasn't sure we were doing this that Dr. Esselstyn and I were on simultaneously. I'm just excited.
I'm excited to
for the future. I'm excited for patients, but personally, it gives me a thrill to be in. I can't say the same room as him, but digitally.
Well, it's digital room. It's a digital room. The same little picture, right?
I want to give a shout out to his wife, Anne, who, if it weren't for her, he wouldn't be on right now.
She figured out the technology, eh?
I'm out. Okay.
Awesome. Do you guys have time for a couple of questions? I don't know if there are any, but if anybody has them, you can raise your hand and I'll see it on your list. You can type it into the chat and I'll ask it. But if you raise your hand, I can open up your line.
Well, Dr. Esselstyn appears to be in a study or his living room. I'm in the office of my restaurant in the basement, and I can hear people baking oil-free breads and such. So I have to go up and make rounds to the customer.
Awesome. Kind of
I'm doctor by day and Ted Danson at Cheers by night. So.
Oh, I love it. I love that you're doing that. That's really getting to people the way that
they must have a very bad practice, because look how messy his office is. It's a restaurant office.
Awesome. It's the restaurant office. There you go. And Maria says, Dr. Khan is hilarious. Thanks for bringing humor. Love it. Let's see. I don't see any other questions. I recommend that everybody just turn up a song. We can make a song out of that. What your list of foods, we could make a song out of that was suggested. Eat your kale if you want an erection. That could work on the men in our lives. Okay. All right. I think we've covered. Thank you. What kind of restaurant? Do you want to tell them what kind of restaurant you have?
I own the largest plant-based restaurant in the Midwest called Green Space Cafe, about 130 seats. It's kind of like Los Angeles and suburban Detroit. But we have an Esselstyn-approved oil-free whole food menu. A few items do have oil, but you can come and eat the large choices that have no added oil, which honors his teachings and our patient base in Detroit.
Right.
And I would suggest you listen to the advice I was given. How do you make a small fortune in the restaurant business? You start with a large fortune, because it's a very challenging thing to do, but we're thriving. We're just celebrating our second year anniversary this week.
Aww.
We have actually calculated we served 150,000 people. We saved 16,000 animals, 160,000 gallons of water. It's a completely, plant-based restaurant and quite unusual in the Midwest. So.
Wow. Well, thank you.
Family enterprise, Dr. Esselstyn and his son Rip we've had the pleasure of hosting them at the restaurant over the last 2 years.
That's awesome. Awesome. One last question and then we'll go. This, because it's a good question. How do you suggest we get quality fat into the diet?
How to get quality?
Fat. I mean, my answer would be whole food fat sources, avocados. Not seeds. Flax seeds.
Yes, absolutely. If, I wouldn't concentrate on it. I'm very, in my language, if you're on a track of reversing disease, you want to follow those blue zone patterns and others that haven't made the blue zone name. Okinawa being the famous one, where 10% or less of calories were from fat. Recently, there's a tribe in Bolivia that's been identified called the Chimani. 14% of their jungle diet is from fat. That would be, by most people, considered extreme in the United States. That's their natural diet. They have the lowest rate of heart disease ever described in 80-year-olds worldwide, and they're in the jungle, and they're eating roots and tubers and plants, and they're not adding in avocados. They're not adding in olives. They eat what they can get, and they're experiencing this extremely unusual good cardiovascular health. So, Okinawans live to over 100 on a diet that's less than 10% of calories that come from natural whole food fats. The body's extremely adaptable, and it seems to be able to make those hormones that we need without excess.
Great.
Yeah, and we're all overweight or struggling with it. These still remain the highest calorie density sources amongst the plant-based worlds. Don't overdo it, and don't do it at all if you're on a reversal regimen, which anybody just go Google Dr. Esselstyn's many YouTubes called No Oil, and you'll have quite a fun time with it all.
Great. Thank you. Well, thank you so much. Oh, and Dr. Khan has given us a free gift, which is the link is in the chat, drrita.com/go/ Young Heart Gift. So be sure to go and download that. And that's it. I so appreciate
it. It's a wrap. Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, dear.
The link is in the chat. I didn't shut off yet, so I want to make sure. The link is right there. It's drritamarie.com/go/youngerheartgift. We'll make sure that that's on the page for you. And have a great rest of the evening. Thank you for being here and for spending the time with us. I hope you found it helpful. Let me put it in again. Maybe she sent it just to me. Oh, all panelists. Okay. All panelists and attendees. There we go. That's why. There we go. How's that? You see it now? You're there, Janine. All right. Bye now, everybody.